You're listening to a podcast hosted by Med Learning Group.
Welcome to the SmartCast Microlearning Podcast hosted by Med Learning Group. My name is Sylvia Hanna, Medical Director at Med Learning Group, and I will be the host of today's podcast. Today, we'll be covering the multidisciplinary approach in the management of cardiorenal risk in patients with chronic kidney disease and type 2 diabetes. Joining me today is Dr. George L. Bakris, Director of the American Heart Association Comprehensive Hypertension Center, Professor of Medicine at the Department of Medicine at the University of Chicago Medicine in Chicago, Illinois. Welcome, Dr. Bakris. It's so good to have you with us today.
Thank you very much. It's good to be here.
So, Dr. Bakris, as we start, can you provide an overview of the cardiorenal risk in patients with chronic kidney disease and type 2 diabetes?
So, type 2 diabetes is a, really, if you think about it, it's not just a metabolic disease, it's a cardiovascular disease, because ultimately what ends up causing death in the majority of these patients is death from cardiovascular disease. And one of the things that is most common in these patients is development of heart failure as they go on. And of course, a lot of them also have atherosclerotic disease. So basically, number one, patients have to know that they have kidney disease, because kidney disease has no symptoms. And so the only way they will know is if the physician or nurse practitioner tells them. And after that, they can work with you to try to slow the progression, which is pretty straightforward. Glucose control, blood pressure control, lipid control. If you do all three of those things and get them to guideline measures, you will dramatically slow kidney disease. And there's some fine-tuning that we'll talk about in a minute, I'm sure. But it is a major problem. In fact, if you look at people on dialysis, not just in the U.S., but in the world, type 2 diabetes is by far the number one cause. And poorly controlled hypertension is number two. And together, they make up almost 72% of the people on dialysis. So clearly, it's an epidemic and it's a big public health problem globally.
Dr. Bakris, what would you say the pillars of therapy are to reduce cardiorenal risk? And can you explain your approach to slow CKD progression and reduce CV risk?
Sure. What I'll give you is kind of the integrated approach and the consensus report, both integrating from the American Diabetes Association and the KDIGO guidelines. And KDIGO is the international kidney guidelines for diabetic disease. And we recently convened a group of which I was a senior member of. And we put together integrating both guidelines. And so that's what I'm about to give you. So number one, as I just said, you need to have blood pressure control to levels of less than 130 over 80. And as part of that blood pressure control, you have to have either an ACE inhibitor or angiotensin receptor blocker at maximally tolerated dose. And the reason for that is that was the dose used in clinical trials. And number two, we have evidence that if you reduce the dose, you do not get the renal benefit. So those are two important factors from a blood pressure standpoint. You have to have glycemic control, hemoglobin A1C is less than 7, and you have to have cholesterol control from data from the SHARP trial that basically showed that up until you get a GFR of 30 or less, cholesterol control actually does help slow progression of kidney disease somewhat. But all three of those are going to reduce cardiovascular disease and help slow progression of kidney disease. Now, the pillars of therapy are adapted from the heart failure model, where you're using multiple drugs that have been shown with different mechanisms that have been shown to slow progression of kidney disease. So here we have the angiotensin receptor blockers or the ACE inhibitors at maximal tolerated dose. We have the SGLT2 inhibitors, which have come to the forefront here in the last decade and clearly have benefits on both the kidney and the heart. And more recently, we have the non-steroidal mineralocorticoid receptor antagonist finerenone, which is very different than spironolactone or eplerenone and has been shown to provide additional benefit independent of SGLT2s on slowing progression of kidney disease and reducing heart failure risk. So those three together form the pillars to support the structure of therapy that incorporate glycemic control, blood pressure control, and reduction in inflammation, which in fact diabetes is a major cause of.
Dr. Backris, you mentioned MRAs. What are the differences between non-steroidal MRAs and steroidal MRAs?
So non-steroidal MRAs are a new class of drug that has really come to the forefront here in the last 5-6 years. And they've been 10 years in development. So the differences are basically that the structure of the molecule is different. One's a steroid molecule, the other one is not. But more importantly, they have different characteristics. They do not have any sexual side effects. They do not penetrate into the brain. The half-life is much shorter than spironolactone, and the specificity for the MR receptor, the receptor where they work to block aldosterone's effect, is much more specific for the non-steroidals than it is for the steroidal molecules. So this agent has all the good things of spironolactone without any of the bad things.
In these patients, hyperkalemia can be an issue. Is there a difference in hyperkalemia experienced in patients treated with spironolactone and patients treated with finerenone?
Absolutely. Everybody wants a head-to-head comparison, big trial and all that. And frankly, that's impractical and going to be very difficult to show. However, the answer to the question is yes, you get about 1/3 to 2/3 less hyperkalemia with finerenone than you do with spironolactone. And to prove this point, we recently published a paper in the Clinical Kidney Journal that basically looked at two different trials, and it corrected for everybody's blood pressure, GFR, and therapy. And we compared people on finerenone to people on spironolactone. Now, these are both resistant hypertension patients. And what we found is there was an 11% development of hyperkalemia in the finerenone group. And in the spironolactone group, there was a 64% development of hyperkalemia. Now, this is the same level of kidney function, GFR is in the 30s, same blood pressure starting off in the 140s, and the difference was really giving the fourth drug for resistant hypertension, which by guidelines is spironolactone, but we compared it to finerenone and combining two different studies. So you get 6 times more hyperkalemia with spironolactone risk than you do with finerenone.
Dr. Backris, healthcare costs are higher than ever these days. The cost of MRAs is very high. Why not just use spironolactone first?
So that's an excellent question. It turns out that you can do that. Nobody's stopping you from doing that. But the problem is that your risk for acute kidney injury is going to be much higher with spironolactone compared to finerenone. That's another study. The other thing is, as I mentioned, the risk for hyperkalemia is going to be higher. So if you have very early kidney disease, that is GFRs of 60, 70, then it probably doesn't matter. You probably get away with it and you probably be okay. However, if you have more advanced disease, the GFRs in the 30s and 40s, we know, number one, spironolactone is going to have a much higher risk for hyperkalemia. We know, number two, there's no data supporting outcomes of kidney disease with spironolactone. And we know, third, that your risk for acute kidney injury is going to be higher. So you get what you pay for. It is cheaper. However, let me also say you shouldn't have to pay exorbitant rates for a new drug. I agree with that. So there are plans now. There are certain insurance plans that provide this drug at a very reasonable price. The company has a system that will defray the cost, and you can even get it for free under certain circumstances. So there are mechanisms that can be used to get this drug. The problem is physicians don't have the time, they don't have the staff to actually do this. So consequently, it's just easier to give spironolactone. So I think you have to use some judgment. If it's very early kidney disease, then yes, you can use spironolactone because there is evidence there that it's actually pretty reasonable. But if you're talking about advanced kidney disease, I really don't think you should go there, because in my experience as a nephrologist, I will tell you that at least 60% of the time, I've gotten in trouble with spironolactone because of potassium issues.
Prior authorizations are needed. What strategies do you utilize to obtain approval?
Well, full disclosure, I work with the staff, and what we do is we know the questions they're going to ask. And so we've developed a letter that tries to address all of these things up front, and we've been submitting it and have had pretty good success with it. But that took time. That took effort on the part of staff to put something together with me reading it and going through it. And if we don't get it on the first pass, we absolutely get it on the second pass. So it's effort. It's a pain in the butt because these guys don't want to pay. So it's as simple as that.
Dr. Backers, the step through process can be difficult. Is finerone available on VA formulary?
Yes, it is available on VA formulary. However, it is restricted to the person has to have exactly the characteristics that we studied. So in other words, if you want to use it in somebody that is not quite meeting the inclusion criteria in the study, they won't give it to you. If you do, they will give it to you. However, because of the expense, it's become more difficult to get than is appreciated. Just because it's on the formulary doesn't mean you're going to get it. So you got to jump through hoops there, but the hoops are different. But the VA patients that I've got have been getting it, so it hasn't really been a big problem, but it's not like falling off a log.
So Medicare covers it as well?
So Medicare does not cover it.
And for patients on Medicare, are there strategies to treatment for these patients?
So the problem is if you only have Medicare, then there really is no strategy. If you don't have Medicare, if you have Medicare but supplemental insurance, then the strategy is you have to get a prior auth. Or if you happen to have really good supplemental insurance, then you don't need a prior auth. It's covered.
Thank you, Dr. Backers. This was very informative, and we learned a lot today. And thank you to our listeners for joining us. This podcast was brought to you by Med Learning Group. Med Learning Group is accredited by the Accreditation Council for Continuing Medical Education to provide continuing medical education for physicians. This CME activity was planned and produced in accordance with the ACCME Essentials. I would like to give a special thank you to our grant supporter, Bayer Healthcare Pharmaceuticals, Inc., who provided an unrestricted educational grant for this activity.